Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Former United States Senator Carl Levin solidified that Levin name in federal-level politics over 36 years that he spent in Washington, D.C. Levin is retired from office and has been a distinguished lecturer in residence at Wayne State University's law school in his hometown of Detroit. It is from his home and retired life in Michigan that he composed his new memoir, Getting to the Heart of the Matter, My 36 Years in the Senate. And joining us now is Carl Levin. Senator, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, it's great to be with you.
There's so much interesting material in this book. It's kind of hard to know where to begin. But I think I want to start with a photo that appears in the book of you and most of the Michigan delegation. John Conyers is there. Fred Upton, Senator Stabenow is there. I think then-Governor Granholm appears in the photo as well. And of course, John Dingell. I think it might be Punchki Day in this photo. And I just wanted to ask what you feel Michigan's leadership brings to the legislative branch that might not otherwise be there.
Well, the delegation from Michigan is always pulled together when it comes to issues for Michigan. We've worked on a bipartisan basis for Michigan's interest, and it was very productive, and I think still is productive when it comes to the issues that Michigan is most interested in. So I focused on, in the memoir you're referring to, my memoir, which has just been published, to the photos of the delegation. But the same thing is focused on in the memoir for the nation. And the working together concept, which is so important for any legislative goal, is important for the nation, too. And that's really what's been missing recently in Congress, is a willingness on the part of some to work across party lines to get things done that the country needs.
One of the other things that's so enjoyable about the book is the stories that you have to tell about so many iconic people that you met. Because of your work on the Senate Armed Services Committee and Homeland Security and the Select Committee on Intelligence, you were one of the faces sometimes representing the U.S. government abroad. And you talk about, you know, meeting Henry Kissinger, working with Anwar Sadat, stories about then-President Reagan, and just really too many world leaders to list. It's kind of a reminder that the world of governing is a bit of a small circle. Everybody kind of knows everybody else, and relationships are frequently in play. Could you talk about what your approach was to talking with people who were working in top levels of government when you had to negotiate, or if you were simply fact-finding?
You know, it was such a treat and so important to meet with people like Anwar Sadat. Here's a guy who put his life on the line. He knew it when he signed the Camp David Accords with Israel, recognizing Israel. And when I met with him, I asked him, and I was lucky enough that he would give me a full hour of his time, just one-on-one. I asked him, I said, you know, your life has been threatened many times. You did something with recognizing Israel, which has created great danger of people who are out to kill you because of what you did. How come you're able to seem so peaceful? How are you able to talk so calmly and to sort of emanate a peaceful attitude and demeanor? And he said it was his Muslim religion, which allowed him to do that. And I think of people who are anti-Muslim and the stereotypes which are created and drawn by some people about other people, including Muslims, and how unfair it is and how divisive it is for those stereotypes to be passed along frequently through the social media, and how important it is that people try to ignore stereotypes that they hear about, not base their attitudes towards other people and other groups based on a stereotype.
When you were traveling abroad on the business of the United States, Were there things that you felt like you as a senator were able to do that someone from the State Department or the Pentagon would have had more trouble accomplishing?
I won't say that I could do things that they couldn't, but the arena in which I was operating, which was the Congress, was a place where, of course, the State Department and others in the executive branch were not able to function because they're appointed in the executive branch, and the legislative branch has very different challenges and opportunities. So what I brought back to my work in the legislative branch was the knowledge of where other people stand on issues, what we might do to advance America's interest and to make the world a safer place, hopefully. But we brought back, for instance, ideas about how to deal with China and their aggressive commercial activities, their discriminatory activities against American goods and against American companies. I met with the number two guy in China, and he gave me an insight, which I used to try to overcome the discriminatory barriers that China uses against American products. And the insight he gave me, by the way, which is, he said, in China we have a saying that business is business. Well, you know, that's the number one communist in the world talking to me there and telling me that from the Chinese point of view, even though they're a communist country, profit is everything. They only care about profit. So I said, well, we have a saying in the United States that business is not everything. There's things like human rights, things like child labor. There's things like safe places to work. There's things like misusing prison labor. Those are important values to us, and profit is not the only thing driving us. We have other values which we put into the mix, but I saw firsthand there how driven the Chinese are towards making a profit just about any way they can.
I don't think a person spends 36 years in the U.S. Senate without gaining a deep understanding of how relationships among legislative colleagues can work. Can you think of an example in which something got done that had a real benefit in the lives of folks at home in Michigan that wouldn't have otherwise happened without the relationships that you developed over your time in office?
Well, I had a really wonderful relationship with a number of Republicans, including John McCain, John Warner. One example, for instance, with McCain was we had a hearing looking into tax abuses by the most profitable companies in the country that were not paying taxes at all or paying reduced taxes because they created these artificial entities overseas in tax havens so that they could avoid paying American taxes. Well, you got the wealthiest companies, the Googles, the Apples, and so forth, that are avoiding taxes. That puts a burden on the rest of us to keep the government's revenues going. And that includes, obviously, people in Michigan. It's not just a Michigan benefit. It's a national benefit, but it surely includes taxpayers in Michigan have a tax burden, and we should not be carrying that burden for the wealthiest among us, including those corporations. And so McCain took a very gutsy position. He went after the president of Apple at a hearing with me in our oversight hearing at Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations. And he took him on with me. And, you know, if for a Republican to take on a big corporation on a tax issue because they're not paying taxes at all or enough, their share, is a courageous thing for McCain to do, and he was a courageous guy generally. So I had a number of very good relationships with various Republicans that work with me on a permanent subcommittee and were with me when I was chair of the Armed Services Committee.
Those relationships, do you think that's what makes the Senate special?
It does. There's a lot of things which contribute to it. We're a smaller body. We get to know people a little bit better than with a much larger body like the house. It also is a special place because you have an opportunity, a guarantee in the Senate, unlike any other legislative body, probably in the world, including the House of Representatives. You're guaranteed an opportunity to offer amendments to legislation which is in front of you. And that opportunity means that everybody can offer a position that they take and have it debated and have it resolved. And that's a really extraordinary benefit of the United States Senate. It's why it should be the world's greatest deliberative body. It's fallen a lot short of that recently for a number of reasons, but that's why it has been called, and at times has been, a great deliberative body.
Can we turn back for a moment to the time in which you were getting involved in politics? You were raised in Detroit, of course, the grandson of immigrants. And you say in the book that your family always talked politics at the dinner table, that lively discussion was just something your family did. You don't make any mention about how your mom felt about you and then eventually your brother Sandy ascending to these national offices. Do you think that that's something that she and perhaps your late father, like what they would have thought of that?
Well, my mother and dad were both deeply committed to public service. They were strong Democrats and believed in FDR. And my dad was very active in public life in a number of ways. My mother was she sort of accepted what came. She was more philosophical about life. She taught us about equality. She said, you're no better than anybody else, but nobody else is better than you, and never forget it. She really, truly believed in that kind of decency towards people. But she also was philosophical about a number of other things. What came, you accept, is part of life. You accept setbacks as part of life. She was raised in a small town in Birmingham, Michigan. And my brother Sandy, our sister Hannah, who's now gone, but my brother and I were taught an awful lot by some loving parents about family and how important family is. And it's first and foremost in our lives. Now we got a nephew. I have a nephew, Andy Levin, who's in public life.
Right.
And he's carried on that tradition. But I also watch our kids. We have three daughters. We have six grandchildren. And I watch how our kids are so close to each other as they're now in their 50s. I see how their six children, two each, how close they are, loving cousins, keep in touch with each other, and how caring they are for their grandparents, how loving they are. So it's family is so important. And I grieve for anybody that has a broken family and where there's quarrels or dissent and divisiveness inside a family. It hurts me, who's been the beneficiary of such a strong family, even to witness where that doesn't exist in other families.
You spent several years working for Michigan's Civil Rights Commission. And then, as you say, catalytic times inspired you to think about public office. Could you tell us about where you were when the uprising happened in 1967?
Yes, I was the chief appellate defender at that time for the defender's office in Detroit. I lived in Detroit. We always have lived in the city and still do. We live downtown. We were representing indigents, representing people who were arrested during that uprising. It was very different from the riot in 1940s, mm-hmm. Because it was not a race riot the way it was in the 40s in Detroit. We have lived in a biracial neighborhood. I remember standing and watching with our neighbors, both races, as the looting was taking place on a nearby street. And it was a very devastating occurrence, obviously, for the people who were involved and people whose businesses were destroyed, and for the city's image and future. Set us back a long time, but we're roaring back now. The last few years have been wonderful to see in Detroit. We just are coming back so strongly, this city. It's an amazing, wonderful thing to see, and something I always had believed would happen, and did whatever I could as a member of the Senate to boost that comeback.
After those several years in Detroit City Council, then you did go on to the Senate in 1978. As I mentioned, a lot of your work ultimately had to do with what was going on with the United States' relationships with other countries, even though you never served specifically on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. This was part of the Armed Services Committee and several other kinds of work that you took on. Why was it that you gravitated toward those kinds of issues, even though they had not really been a part of your portfolio before that?
Yeah, I had never served in the military. And I felt that was a gap in my life, and I wanted to learn as much as I could about the military. And I really am impressed by our military. I am impressed by the leadership that understands civilian control and follows it. I'm impressed by the leadership that takes such time to read and understand our history. I have tremendous respect for people who put their lives on the line for this country. I had personal relationship in the Senate, as a matter of fact, with two men who had given parts of their bodies for our country. Bob Dole, who lost the use of his arm, and Danny Inouye, who lost an arm. And the amazing part about both was how positive they were as people. In Danny Inouye's case, how he served his country, our country, with such dedication as part of a Japanese-American unit, because it was segregated. And that unit saw more conflict and had greater losses than any other unit in the military. And here's a guy whose family was incarcerated.
Was being detained, yeah.
Detained in these camps, and not given their rights as American citizens. And he's out there fighting for America. And it's very, very touching. I was very close to Danny Inouye for a lot of reasons. And he, by the way, I was able to get our facility in Battle Creek named after Inouye and Dole and Phil Hart, who's an extraordinary man. The three of them served together in the military. And they were in that hospital when it was a hospital in Battle Creek. And Hart took care of Inouye and Dole if they needed something because they couldn't get it themselves. They were injured, wounded. He would get up to get them food or drink or cigarettes, whatever. And Phil Hart took care of them. And the building now, as a result of our bill, is named the Hart Dole Inouye Federal Center in Battle Creek.
You tell a spectacular story from one of your trips overseas in the 1980s, with a guy who at the time was your Senate colleague, but who is now the President of the United States. Can I ask you to share the conversation you saw Joe Biden have with the man who was then the second in command in the Soviet Union, Alexei Kosygin?
Well, we were new senators in 79 or 80 he took us. And Biden invited us to join him as the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee to go to Russia to meet with Russian leadership. You know, we sat around this table with Kosygin, head of the Communist Party, I believe at the time, number two anyway. And we, you know, first heard from Joe as the leader of our delegation. I think there were four or five of us. And then Kosygin responded. And his response was just total Soviet propaganda. And Joe, being the blunt and direct guy he is, in response to Kosygin, said something like, well, we have an old saying in Delaware, you can't bullshit a bullshitter, which he shortened it to, you can't BS a BS guy like me. I know how to BS, and I know when I see it. And so afterwards, I asked the interpreter, you know, how did you interpret that into Russian? And her answer was, you can't fool a comrade. And I looked at her and said, wow, yeah, that's not what he said, but I guess you softened it for the diplomatic purposes. But at any rate, Biden was great then. He's great now. He's a direct guy. He combines a sense of humor with deep beliefs and things that I think most Americans believe in, which is the needs and rights of everybody, equal protection under the law of all groups. People ought to have opportunity. We ought to deal with poverty and racism. And he's genuine. He's authentic. That's something about Joe Biden which people crave, I think, even if you don't like him. He's authentic. He's real. And people want that in their public officials.
Having the background that you do, coming from Detroit and having worked on civil rights and affirmative action issues and so many related things for so long, can you say a few words about what it meant to you to see Barack Obama elected president?
Well, I was with Barack Obama in the Senate, so I knew what kind of a guy he is, which is another authentic, smart, decent guy. It was very, very meaningful to me to see him personally because I knew him and know him as a person and his wife. My wife, Barbara, and his wife, obviously his Senate spouses then, came to know each other too. And at any rate, the election itself was the most exciting election that I'd ever participated in, a presidential election, since President Kennedy. When President Kennedy was running, I was active in his campaign. There was tremendous excitement about John Kennedy as a candidate. The crowds were huge, and the feeling was really strong that he could make a difference for our country. And the excitement about young people for John Kennedy at that time was great. I felt great being part of it. But the 08 election with Barack Obama was, after the Kennedy election, the most exciting election that I participated in my life. And I watched young people get involved who had not been involved before. And so it was a magnificent moment, I thought, for the country to elect the first African-American, but also somebody who genuinely believed that all people should have a fair opportunity. He was a guy who does not stereotype, who knows how to compromise to get things done. I saw that in the Senate, where he worked across the aisle with Republicans to get things done for the country. And I was confident he would do the same as president, which is exactly what he did.
Do you think that his time in office improved America's attitudes on race?
Yes, I do. Even people who are still racist or still bigoted, and some of those surely existed. And the most recent ex-president, Trump, surely exploited that, that feeling on the part of many, divided us along those lines. But there was definitely an improvement, a step forward in terms of race in America and the need for people to see others as human beings. And so Obama's, obviously his election didn't eliminate racism. That's a long-term process, but we've made some important steps, and that election was won.
There are a lot of things that are hard to understand about the last 4 years, but I think one that is really hard for many people is understanding what happened in the Senate while Donald Trump was president. As somebody who has a great love for the Senate as an institution, can you shed any light on the way that Senate Majority Leader McConnell, what he was doing in the Senate and the way he was using power during the time that Trump was president?
Well, I think he was appealing to a Republican base and would do anything in order to keep Republican control, including some things which were highly divisive in terms of achieving national goals. And he took some very rigid ideological positions from a right-wing perspective. I think he was doing that for political purposes because he thought that doing so would maintain a Republican base, which he felt then was the key to maintaining the Senate in the Republican majority. But he's very political. On the other hand, I think he does respect the institution. The institution itself, he used the so-called nuclear option to arbitrarily and against the rules and the filibuster, and that resulted in some Supreme Court judges, which would not have been confirmed if he hadn't violated the rules. But in fairness to McConnell, and I have very deep differences with McConnell, he didn't start that. We started that as Democrats when we ignored the rules to get some district court judges confirmed. And of course, the reason that was done was because the Republicans were able to, just by threatening to filibuster, prevent those nominees of Barack Obama to the district courts to be voted on and confirmed. But that also was partly our fault because we failed, we Democrats failed to force the people threatening to filibuster to actually filibuster. And that was our shortfall because too many of us, and understandably, didn't want to give up weekends and nights and watching our kids play soccer and so forth. We were unwilling to give up our own lives, basically, in order to force the Republicans to carry out the threat, which they would not have done, I believe, on district court judges. So it was frustration with the Republican threats of filibuster, but which we allowed to succeed by not forcing them to carry out the filibusters, that triggered then the frustration that we understandably had and our majority leader understandably had with Republicans thwarting votes on Obama's district court nominees. But then that was the precedent to do what the Democrats, you know, had previously done. That mm-hmm. led to the Supreme Court judges getting confirmed.
Right. Given everything that's happened and the tone in the Senate right now, do you think if you were a younger man, you would still be interested in serving there?
Oh, absolutely. It's the greatest place that I can imagine, other than a presidency, to be involved in public service, which is so important that people respect and understand I think honor by the way in which they practice their public service and get engaged looking for the good of the cause or the state or the district and not after just always trying to do what's popular, which is a way of assuring one's own reelection. And that shouldn't be the motive. It shouldn't be doing the popular thing. It should be a willingness to, after thinking about it, listening to people, not being arrogant, doing what you think is best for your district, if you're elected official or your state. But there's so many forms of public service. It's not just elected public service. There's 100 different ways that people can serve their communities. And I think this country is so the foundation, in a way, is helping each other, respecting each other, serving each other, sacrificing for each other, being part of a community. We talked about family before, which is number one in my book, but community is number two. Being part of a community that you are serving and helping in charitable ways, in giving, in volunteer work. There's just so many ways of really being a public servant. And this country's been famous for that kind of commitment, and I hope always will be.
Senator Carl Levin's new memoir is Getting to the Heart of the Matter, My 36 Years in the Senate. Senator Levin, thank you so much.
Good being with you, April.